Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust. It's wonderful to have you with us. Thank you for giving some of your time and attention on your weekend to look at the concerns of the least of these, to examine how it is that we can protect children in our society. Because there is, I believe, no higher biblical calling other than worshiping the Lord with all of our heart than bringing justice on behalf of the most vulnerable. And it's interesting, we're going to talk a little bit about Zechariah, like literally one of my favorite Old Testament prophets. But the reason this came to my mind is I was doing an interview this week with a woman from South Africa who was talking about how the rights of children are being eroded in her country because, you know, spoiler, the rights of children are under attack everywhere. And she was talking about why doesn't the church stand up for children? Shouldn't we be the ones that are doing this? My answer to that is because we have actually gotten the kingdom of God wrong. In America, in American churches, we have just oversimplified to the point of watering down the gospel to something very simple: love God and love people. Now, that is awesome, except that sometimes our definition of love means affirmation, means validation of adults, and we are afraid to challenge something that might make an adult feel uncomfortable or sad. And that is a problem, because I was reading through Zechariah and I was in chapter 8, which talks about this incredible restoration. Like, it's very like, is this a literal or is it a prophetic vision of the restoration of Israel? Is it the literal kingdom of, is it the spiritual church at the end? Hard to tell, but I will tell you what, Zechariah gives us a summary of what it is that restoration looks like. And he says this: these are the things that you shall do. Speak truth to one another. Render in your gates judgments that are true and make peace. We have got to get back to the place in the church, local or global, where we understand that one of the core aspects of what it means to really be the church, to be the salt and light, yes, it is to welcome those who have questions. Yes, it is to mourn with those who mourn and comfort the brokenhearted. But I will tell you what, rendering right judgments, speaking the truth, must be a central aspect of your role as a Christian individually, but also that should be happening corporately at your local body, in your local congregation. And when we do that, the church actually becomes the greatest fortress that protects the weak and vulnerable. Children, yes, but yes, the disabled, yes, the elderly, yes, the unwanted, yes, the outcast. Speaking truth is a huge part of that, especially in light of the very concerning developments in reproductive technologies that we're seeing with IVF, with the eugenics that go with that, with surrogacy and all of that. We're going to talk a little more about that in the second session here, where we're going to interview Emma Waters. But we're at the place where, church, you have got to be the ones that are speaking up, and then you must render true judgments. We're going to hit some trending news, but as always, I've got Josh Wood, my executive director here, to kind of work through one of these headlines with me. Josh, any thoughts on the importance of speaking truth and rendering right judgments when it comes to the church?
Well, I think it's interesting. So in the UK, even, there's positions in the House of Lords for clergy. So they give clergy a specific political role because, and it's a defined seat, it's not up for election, because they believe there is a role to play in speaking truth into the political process that's almost prophetic and unique to the Christian and the church. So first off, I love that. I think the church does need to have a prophetic voice of truth. What I'm also aware of is in times of, let's say, cultural neutrality, where things aren't as crazy as they've been the last 10 years, there's almost this like, or maybe even 5 years, there's almost this like, well, do we really need to be worried about X? Do we really need to speak truth to Y? And you get this church that's developed this kind of seeker-sensitive movement that really tries to avoid difficult topics at all costs. I actually saw a video today of Phil Vischer. He was talking about, this guy challenged him and said, well, there probably will come a day when your religious views will intersect with sex and gender, and the state will step in to defend the child against you, the Christian, because your Christian views on sex and gender will oppose the state's view of kind of letting a child define all of this themselves. And they're going to call it harm, and it's going to be a problem. And this, he said, so what are you going to do when they come for your kids? And Phil said, who's going to come for my kids? Rock and roll? Do you think they're going to get, and he's like kind of made a joke out of like, they're going to get captured by drugs and rock and roll. And that's like almost like making it a joke. And it made me think, you know, it looked really bad today because the bill was attached, or they attached the video to a bill from Colorado that explicitly gives the state some power to do this, to kind of investigate and to look at is this really the type of family we want raising a kid? Because a state might have overriding concerns about them being able to live out their gender ideology. So it made me think, you know, in times of neutrality, when things don't feel crazy, this argument where the church doesn't need to be this place of truth, doesn't need to be this almost divisive figure that divides the sheep from the goats and talks about truth and talks about, gives an opinion that can cut a little bit on hard things to protect kids. Well, nowadays, today's world, I think it's becoming more and more clear, to whom will we turn? Politicians can't be trusted to look 4 years, more than about a year in advance, right? Everything's about political wins, not taking a sacrificial stand for truth. On the flip side, I think we need now more than ever the church who's not politically invested, who's not financially invested, who's not bought and paid for, to stand up and go, I don't care if there's three of us in the pews. We don't go past this line. And if going across this line means I get 150, well then, you know, to be honest, I've ceased to be what I was intended to be in the first place. So what good am I?
Well, I'll let somebody that the readers are very, that the listeners are very familiar with sort of cap off this section. A man that we know and love said, do not think that I have come to bring peace on earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword. And when there's a angelic announcement of him arrival, it says peace on earth, goodwill to those who fear him. Okay. But generally, this is not a religion. This is not a worldview that is going to bring peace among all people. If we are doing what we want, if we are rendering true judgments, if we are speaking truth, as it says in Zechariah, we're going to rile some feathers. We might even create some friction. And that is not just okay. That is your mandate. Because you standing for truth means that those who do not have a voice are going to be protected. So on the topic of giving children a voice, the Utah governor actually made a decision on March 24th through House Bill 129, which gives adults who were adopted the right to see their birth records, including their original birth certificate. Now, this is something that adult adoptees, have been asking for decades, and they try state by state to obtain copies of their original birth certificates. Now, let me just go back and explain a little bit of why it is that these birth records are not immediately available to adoptees. When adoption first kind of became more mainstream in like the 60s and the 70s, obviously it followed on the heels of the sexual revolution, where there were a lot more girls who were getting pregnant out of wedlock, which is a sign that the sexual revolution didn't do women or babies any favors. But there was still a high stigma around being a single mother. And so a lot of these women were shuffled off to, birth mother homes, where they would be pregnant for 3 or 4 months. They would give birth. They would go home. They would never tell anybody that they had a baby. And oftentimes the baby wasn't necessarily told that they were adopted. Or if they were, they were not given information about their birth mother or identifying information or medical records or anything like that. And then the kids grew up and they actually wanted to know, who's my mother, especially? They'd love to know their birth father, but actually had a serial foster father, a guy who had lots and lots of foster kids come through his home. And he said 100% of them, 100% said, who's my mother? I want to know who my mother is. There's something about wanting to know the identity of your mother that's fundamental to what it means to be human. And so adoptees, for the longest time, have asked that question, but they could not look at their birth certificate for the answer. That's because back in the 60s and 70s, when we were first dealing with this new wave of children who needed to be adopted because of the sexual revolution, we instituted a practice of reissuing a new birth certificate. So let's say that that single mom gave birth and her name was Jane Brown. Jane Brown would be on the birth certificate. Maybe the name of the father was blank because maybe she didn't know the father. Maybe he didn't want to be identified. Maybe it was, you know, Curtis Shanahan or something like that. But then when the adoption took place, the state would issue a new birth certificate with the adoptive parent's name on it. Even if the parents adopted the child 2 months later, or maybe even 2 years later. And then the original birth certificate would be sealed and nobody could get to it. Nobody could access it. So then adoptee groups started to lobby and say, we want that information. That's important to us. It's hard for us to answer the question, who am I? Because we cannot answer the question, whose am I? We have a right to know the identity of the people who gave us life. And slowly, state by state, they've started to win. So that is what took place here in Utah. From a children's rights perspective, as people who believe that adoption is an institution centered around the well-being of children, and who believe children have a right to their mother and father, this is the kind of thing that we really support.
I may be taking an unpopular view. I can understand, though, the opposition. I think it would be really scary having gone all these years under a promise that the person that I gave up for adoption would never contact me, wouldn't know, and you almost have like taken that out of your mind. And now I know some will be really relieved that they finally reached out. But man, I think this is a needed correction. I think this is the way we should be up front. You know, but I also, Katie, I'm honest, like I feel for some of those women who would, you know, what if they would have chosen abortion had they not been given the guarantee of anonymity? And so I'm like, man, this will probably cause some like serious reckoning with families. And we need to, you know, not take that lightly, that these are fundamental, very difficult issues. But I do agree that going forward, this has to be a child-centered institution, and that means putting some power back in their hands, that they are the ones that get to decide whether they want to have a connection back with their biological parents.
Well, and I think some of these sort of adoption era rulings are crumbling because in some ways it's being made irrelevant through at-home DNA tests. Now, yeah, that's a lot true. Of kids are going to be able to piece it together on their own. But it's interesting because this was put in place not necessarily because birth mothers asked for it, and not necessarily because it was in the best interest of the child. They did it because they didn't want to make it look like the child was illegitimate. They thought this is going to be good for kids because we don't want to make it look like this child was born out of wedlock.
I mean, that's interesting.
Yeah, it was like they really thought this is going to be best for the kids, for them to never know, for there not to be any questions about, you know, how they came to be. And was this, we don't say the word bastard much anymore, but that was very much kind of playing into this mentality. We don't want to have this child have any kind of stigma. Let's just pretend and make sure that the state gets behind this great pretending that this child came from the man and woman who are raising them.
Then I'd applaud. I mean, I think we all have to applaud that. There are two competing interests here, and they knew they'd get some flack, and yet the state of Utah said, well, but the child wins, and we're going to go through the process to make sure that's true. They deserve credit for that.
Yeah, so we're fans. Some of what we've do at Them Before Us is we advocate for truthful birth certificates. Right now, we've got adulteration taking place in the realm of birth certificates, not from adoption only, but often through parents who create children through sperm and egg donation and surrogacy, who then want to put two mothers or two fathers on the birth certificate. I mean, something that is objectively false. And yet they are using the birth certificate as a tool to validate adult emotions. We're not fans. We think birth certificates serve kids, and that is what Utah determined this week.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
During this second segment, we are going to expose you to a little bit of the IVF deep dive that we did over at Them Before Us podcast. We have a separate platform where we do a very serious dive into all things marriage and family, from testimonials to talking with different allies and partners. And we also did an entire series on exposing the dark underbelly of the IVF fertility world. So we're going to give you just a glimpse into a conversation that we had with Emma Waters. Emma Waters is a policy analyst in the Tech Policy Center at the Heritage Foundation. Her work focuses on family biotechnology and reproductive medicine. She is a friend of Them Before Us. She is a go-to expert. She has done some groundbreaking reporting, especially as it relates to fertility tourism and fertility fraud. So enjoy this. I know that you're going to have your eyes opened in ways that you were not even aware of when it comes to what's happening in the world of big fertility.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Them Before Us podcast, our special IVF series. You're back with Jen Friesen, training director and podcast host, and our engagement director, Patient Sunny, as we continue interviewing experts all across the biotechnology, bioethics, reproductive technology kind of field and expertise. And today we are chatting with Emma Waters. She is a senior research associate for the Richard and Helen DeVos Center for Life, Religion, and Family at the Heritage Foundation. Her work focuses on family, bioethics, and reproductive technology policy. And Emma has actually been on the show before, which I'll make sure I put in our show notes so people can go see your first conversation. But Emma, thanks so much for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you guys for having me on.
We're really looking forward to this conversation because we think you're wicked smart when it comes to these topics, and we're excited to hear from you. But before we get into dive a little deeper more into reproductive technology and the things that you're here to share, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself personally, maybe kind of your career track? What brought you to be interested in the topics that you focus on for your career?
Yeah, this is a great question. So somewhere about two-thirds of the way through college a couple of years ago, I stumbled across the field of family policy. So looking at the impact of marriage and a family structure on children, on our society's well-being, and then really just fell in love with that whole area of research, and particularly the aspect of policy, that not only do we understand and study and know what is good and true for families, but we can actually do something about it through our public policy process. And that just became really a bit of an addiction. It was everything I read. But I became very interested in technology in particular, started working for a technology podcast, and realized that technology really is transforming our understanding of what it means to be human, specifically at the earliest stages of conception and procreation. So I actually stumbled across Katie's Them Before Us book, read it, and then just totally fell in love. And a few years after that, when I was interviewing at Heritage, they asked me what policies I wanted to pick up and what I thought was really important for the future of the movement. And so I pitched them on bioethics and reproductive technology. And at the time, this was a couple of years ago, I was like, guys, trust me, this is going to become a really big deal in international politics. Like, we want to have someone who's on this. And for better and for worse, that certainly has come true. So here we are today.
Yeah, so just for our audience, you know, we're in the middle of a series on IVF. What if IVF becomes a right? But, you know, for this episode, we're looking at surrogacy, which is something that people don't always think of when they hear IVF. So can you just give our audience a brief overview, surrogacy 101, what's going on with this newish area of technology?
Yeah, absolutely. So surrogacy comes in four forms. There's gestational surrogacy, where the surrogate is not related to the child that she carries. And then there's traditional surrogacy, where the surrogate is also the biological mother of the child. Now, in traditional surrogacy, you could typically use something like artificial insemination just to impregnate the woman with the understanding that she gives the baby away. But with gestational surrogacy, what we tend to find is that IVF is essential for that process, because whether or not the parents who are going to raise the child are the biological parents, they use IVF in order to create the embryo before placing it in the surrogate. And then after that, there's two compensation models for surrogacy. So the first is commercial surrogacy, where the surrogate's getting paid anywhere from $25,000 to $70,000 just to carry and birth the child alone. And then there's altruistic surrogacy, where the surrogate is ostensibly doing this out of the kindness of our heart just to help out a family member or a close friend. Now, in those situations, it's still a bit of a misnomer to say altruistic surrogacy, because the surrogate's still being reimbursed for thousands of dollars of maternity clothes, nutrition, any medical bills, prenatal vitamins, things like that. And then on top of that, while we don't have exact data on this, some studies that we found have said that only about 2% of all surrogacy contracts in the United States are actually altruistic in nature, whereas about 98% of all surrogacy agreements really are in that commercial model, where certainly there is the desire on the part of the surrogate to help another couple out in many cases. But at the same time, they're getting paid upwards of like $70,000, which is over the median income wage in the United States. So this is certainly a very lucrative endeavor for the surrogate, as well as the agencies that are coordinating this. And so beyond that, I think one of the really important things to keep in mind is that surrogacy introduces the possibility of a child having up to three quote-unquote mothers. In surrogacy, you could have the biological mother of the child who contributes the egg in the child's development. You have the surrogate mother, who's the gestational mother. The child really only knows that woman as his or her quote-unquote mother through all 9 months of pregnancy and labor. And then you have the relational mother, or the intended mother, who actually raises the child. And so when it comes to thinking about surrogacy from the perspective of child well-being, this introduces a host of concerns that you all lay out so incredibly well. When it comes to the child's conception of who they are, as well as who their parents are in that situation. But for each of those, each of those developments in surrogacy, you really do have to have a well-defined in vitro fertilization industry to enable that level of surrogacy to occur.
Can I ask you two follow-ups, just thoughts? You know, we've been following some of the legal shifts and changes where a state will already have altruistic surrogacy legal. And then you're saying that's about 2% of what, of all the surrogacy contracts. And then there's a big fight and a push to legalize commercial patients. Maybe remind us which states, I feel like, just did this. They were the M1s. There's so many M1s.
Massachusetts and Michigan passed it last year. And then most states kind of fall in that legal gray area where there isn't a law saying it's explicitly legal, but they're kind of doing it anyway.
Yeah. So Emma, do you think, what's the push to then get commercial? Is it really just about, oh, I want to be able to do it for my sister or my friend? Because then all of a sudden it's, well, wait, that's the big business side that's pushing it.
No, it's absolutely right. Well, so I think a perfect example of this is New York in 2021. So New York was actually one of the more recent states to actually legalize commercial surrogacy. And what's so interesting about this story is, as you're pointing out, altruistic surrogacy was always legal in the state of New York since the technology was enabled. But Senator Brad Holyman, a state senator there, he and his male partner really campaigned to legalize commercial surrogacy because they claimed they couldn't find any women who were willing to serve as a surrogate for them. So they were being, quote, forced to go all the way to the state of California, where majority of surrogacy contracts take place, in order to find a woman willing to carry a child for them. Now, of course, the big difference between California and New York at the time was that California paid upwards of $70,000 and New York didn't. And so that example really highlights to me that in a majority of cases, while women, I think, again, do have the desire to help another couple, they're not actually willing to do it in the majority of the cases without pay. I mean, they couldn't find anyone in the entire state. So instead, they had to pass a law enabling women to get paid a large sum of money in order to make the endeavor really worth it for them on a couple of levels.
Wow. And then the other question I had for you, just following up your first thought, was, do we see really the same kind of women that are always surrogates and the same kinds of couples always buying it? Or is that more sort of our anecdotal we see the news and we see this or that. You know, is there kind of one group that tends to be buying and one group that tends to be getting rented?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think there's really two, I'll put it this way, depending on your view of surrogacy, whether you're positive or tend to have a more critical view of it, that shapes the sort of woman that you envision participating. So if you have a very positive view of surrogacy, you tend to think of a middle-class woman who likely has kids at home or has to have kids at home in order to qualify as a surrogate, who wants to be a stay-at-home mom in some cases and is just looking for a job that will help her cover the bills, but also allow her to be there with her kids. And so in those cases, it's a very healthy relationship between a woman who benefits from the money, but is not in need of the money in a serious way. If you tend to take a more critical view of surrogacy, you tend to think about it through the lens of exploitation, and particularly the exploitation of women who are in serious financial need, who were doing this because otherwise, like, they wouldn't be able to make ends meet. And so that tends to introduce this level of coercion to the conversation, that this isn't simply a free act that a woman is doing, but is something that she feels like she has to do, that she has to rent out her body in this incredibly intimate process in order to somehow make ends meet, provide for her children, something along those lines. The tricky thing is that because we don't have any state or federal data really tracking this issue, fertility clinics typically say that they require women to be of a certain socioeconomic status to prevent low-income women from doing it out of this sense of coerced need. However, there's no law regulating that. There's no law requiring it. And we certainly have instances where that's abused. And then on the part of intended parents, it really runs the gamut. Obviously, men don't have a womb, so they're just biologically in need of a woman. So in a lot of cases, you see single men or male same-sex couples who are pursuing this industry. And in many cases, I think that tends to be the demographic that's really pushing for the expansion of surrogacy so wholeheartedly because they don't have a viable partner who has a womb, and they may or may not have a community that has a woman who feels comfortable sharing her body in that way. So while I can't say what percentage that is, I think that tends to be the demographic that's really animating this, outside of just men and women who, for whatever reason, the woman's unable to carry a child or unwilling in the case of Lily Collins.
Yeah, and that kind of gets at another question. We've kind of seen this progression in language from like a right to IVF to a right to surrogacy. And you brought up male same-sex couples. I know there's a case that was brought up in New York where a male same-sex couple said that they were being discriminated against because their insurance wasn't going to cover IVF. Can you speak to that issue a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So that example in New York is par for the case of the sort of IVF and surrogacy progression that we're seeing in the United States. So a lot of this language really originates with an advocacy organization called Men Having Babies. Now, Men Having Babies, as the name implies, is a group for men who are single or in same-sex relationships who want the opportunity to become parents. And so they have a number of initiatives that they have introduced over the past few years. But one of the primary ones is this idea of what they call fertility equality. And so they claim that not having the right to IVF and, by an extension, not having the right to surrogacy is a form of discrimination against a single man or a male same-sex couple because it's barring them from the opportunity to become a parent of a child, whether or not they're biologically related to that child. And of course, that introduces a host of problems, namely that they don't have a womb, that there isn't actually a natural way for them to have children apart from a relationship with a woman. And so on top of their fertility equality push, they have pushed something, or they've really advocated for the redefinition of infertility in state law. So in 2022, Illinois enacted the first state law that actually redefined infertility, not only to include the inability to get pregnant based on underlying reproductive health conditions, something that's a very real problem for many men and women across the United States. But then they added a line saying, and also your relationship status or your social status, depending on the state, determines whether or not you're fertile or or not. And so what that effectively means is that if you're in need of a egg or sperm from a donor, that you're considered infertile, whether or not your body is fertile or not. So in many of these cases, these men are perfectly healthy. They have the ability to conceive a child. They just don't have a viable partner or relationship that allows them to do that. So since that push, Illinois redefined infertility along those lines in 2022. As I mentioned, California did in 2024. New Jersey did in 2023. And a number of other states, New York included, have proposals in place to redefine infertility along these terms. And so part of the goal for them is not merely that IVF coverage is allowed, but that surrogacy, commercial surrogacy is allowed. And it, as weird as it sounds, right, to I think very like normal people, like there really is a staunch belief that because they desire a child, then they have the right to whatever technology and whatever body parts are necessary to have a child, including the womb of another woman, which is incredibly violating when you start to think about it along those lines.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Welcome back to the final segment of Them Before Us Radio. We're so glad you joined us this weekend. It's great to kind of look through what's happening in the world, what's happening in the landscape of both adoption and in terms of reproductive technologies. We're going to bring it a little closer to home here. We're going to answer some of the questions that you have sent in through the week. And to do that, as always, we have the Them Before Us Training Director, Jen Friesen, here to pitch us some of the questions that you have been thinking about in between radio episodes. So Jen, thanks so much for being with us again.
Hi, Katie. You are so welcome. And it's my pleasure to be here. I love cultivating questions from comments we get, whether they're directly questions or they're comments or they're kind of things that pop up in pop culture that I personally would like your take on for your listeners. I love presenting things to you, especially when you don't necessarily know what I'm going to say. So let's hop right into it and see if, well, we're not going to stump you with these, I think, because some of these are kind of going to tap into your personal experience. But the first big one that we have today is, what would be your encouragement for the adults who listen to, whether it's our Them Before Us podcast or the radio show, and they have made some of these decisions that have hurt kids or violated their natural rights? So let's say it's the folks who, you know, single parent by choice, they've used a sperm donor or egg donor, they've used a surrogate, but now they've, you know, heard from us or read our materials and they're recognizing this is going to hurt my kid, or I can see how it's impacting my child. What do we do? Or what encouragement do we give to people? You can't undo that you used a sperm donor at some level. Or if it's a same-sex couple and that is the decision they're making to live and raise their kids in that setting, but they do acknowledge, you know, we're two women and we aren't giving our son something valuable he needs. What's the advice that we give?
I don't think that those people are alone because they talk to us and they think, well, I thought that I was enough. Like I thought that as long as I really, really wanted a baby, I could go to the sperm bank and I could have a baby and the baby was going to be just fine because I was like so wanted to be a mom and I had all the love to give and I was financially stable. But then their child gets to be 9 or 12 or 15. And it's very, very clear that mom simply does not have everything that that child needs, especially as it relates to emotional connection and investment. And as these children start struggling with their identity and asking questions about who am I that the parents are not able to answer, or maybe the old answers that they gave of you don't have a dad, you have two moms, no longer satisfies them. Or they see their child slipping into a depression state because they are so unhappy and the world has said, you should be happy. The messages they're hearing from the world is, you're so lucky that you have two moms who love you. And that often kind of functions as a bit of gaslighting for these kids because they innately long to be loved by both their mother and their father. And when the world does not reflect back those innate longings, they're going to have to find fault somewhere, and they usually find fault with themselves. It must be me. I'm the one that's wrong. There's something wrong with me for wanting what every human child throughout human history has ever wanted, their own mother and father loving them. It's so funny. I was at an event just yesterday talking with a woman who saw a baby at Costco, a two-year-old at Costco who had two dads. You know, it's very clear this is a two-dad family. And like all women, we start talking to the baby, right? So she goes up and she starts talking to the baby. Oh my gosh, honey, how are you? How are you? And she's this like 2.5-year-old girl who's verbal. And she just was reaching, like lunging out of the shopping cart, reaching for this woman. And she kind of looked at the dads like, is it okay if I pick your kid up? And they're like, oh yeah, you know, she'd love to say hi. So she picked her up and the girl is just grabbing onto her and literally in her 2-year-old voice said, can we take her home? Can we take her home? There is something about children. They know what they need and they know what they want. Maybe they can't verbalize it. Maybe they're afraid to verbalize it. But children need, deserve, and have a right to their mother and father. So sometimes you don't realize this when you're in the process of forming that family that excludes the child's mother or father. But maybe you're at the place where you can't deny it anymore. So what do? You apologize. You go to your kid. You tell them the story. I thought this was going to be okay. I really believed that I, as a single mom, or we as two dads, that we were going to have everything that you needed. And we pretended for a long time like we did because we love you and you're wonderful. But now I see that we have wronged you and we're sorry and we can't take it back. But what we can do is say, we validate you and you're right. You're right for feeling like something is missing because something is missing. You are missing something that you were made for. And then I would encourage you to be the safest place for your child to process that kind of loss with. Because obviously they're suffering, like all kids who have lost their mother or father suffer through this question. But what's worse than suffering is suffering in isolation. Like, try to make sure that they are not having to process this alone. Because they're probably going to come to the wrong conclusions, namely that it's their fault, or there's something wrong with them, or there's a reason why their mother or father did not want them. So even though it's going to be painful, even though you're going to have to acknowledge that you contributed to their pain, don't let them process it alone. Do you have thoughts, Jen? Because I know you're really familiar with a lot of the stories that we share online, in our book. You've interviewed different children that have experienced family breakdown. What would you add in terms of advice?
My main thought was, even as a woman who doesn't have children, how heartbreaking it is to imagine a child that doesn't have mom. That, yeah, it's like to be raised by two men, to be raised by a single man. It just like blows my mind as a woman. Just think, and by, I mean the same on the flip side for a boy that doesn't have a dad with them, right? So it just seems like, you know, I think we've talked before about even finding some kind of, and I mean surrogate in the sense of a stand-in, a person who really would be safe, but would invest in your children or those connections to give them an element of that other side of the gender balance that they need, I think would be so important. And everything else you said was so well said.
Yeah, agree. That you may not be able to give them their mother or father, but maybe your own father or mother could stand in and give them some of the maternal or paternal love that they are craving. Obviously, you need to be careful about anybody that you're bringing into your child's life because some other man or woman is not going to have the natural protectiveness and investment that the child's own mother or father would have had. So you need to screen those adults carefully. But yeah, like, you need to meet their need for the missing mother or father love, because the ways they may try to meet that need on their own could be pretty risky for them.
Yeah. Okay. We transitioning to the next one. We hear so many negative things about having children in our culture. There, you know, people talk about child-free weddings, child-free vacations, child-free restaurants, basically that children, it's kind of interesting. It's kind of a lot of people going back to this, children should be neither seen nor heard sort of culture. But there was a big kind of cultural dust up a few weeks ago with a singer-songwriter named Chappelle Roan, who I have barely heard of. So I don't know if a ton of folks have heard of her, but she was on a podcast and she talked about her friend. She identifies as gay, but she talked about her friends who are parents, young parents. She's probably in her mid-20s. And she said she doesn't know a single one of her friends with children who's happy. And she used things like, they don't have any light in their eyes. They're in hell. None of them have slept. Now that one might be accurate. But it was, it caused a lot of backlash because it was just so negative. A bunch of people told her, you know, responded to her on Twitter and said, you need a bigger friend group. Probably you need some more people in your life. You probably need more people who aren't right in the thick of it, maybe with a newborn where they're completely sleep deprived. And it is really hard. But I'd love to hear from you, Katie, whether you have thoughts on her comments or not, but maybe even just some perspective on what are the best parts that you experienced, the best from each of these stages. There's hard things in every stage when you're raising kids. And now you have two adult kids and two teenagers. But what would you say were those highlights for those major development sections that you experienced as a parent?
There is so much anti-child messaging going on out there from influencers. And like you said, you know, now we've got these kid-free zones. And it's kind of like the more people don't have children, the more it's hard to have children around you. So it's a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy in some ways. And children are hard, you know, especially the newborns, especially infants are hard. But it's interesting because, you know, she equates the hard with bad. But the reality is that there's a pretty direct connection with things that are challenging and things that are meaningful. It's almost like the things that are the most meaningful in our lives have the most amount of challenge and sacrifice. And so that is true. You know, when you first have an infant or a newborn or even like the toddler years, I actually tell people, like, if they have a child that's under 3 years old, I say, you're still in the exhaustion phase of parenting. And you really are. Like, even when your child is quote unquote sleeping through the night, they're still getting up a couple times for different reasons throughout the week. And you're just so tired. You don't realize it. Does that mean that they're in hell? Oh God, absolutely not. I mean, it's pretty amazing to have a sweet baby sleeping on your chest. It's amazing to see them start to discover the world around them. It's amazing to see the dependence that they have on you and, like, as a mother, how your body sustains them and keeps them alive. And then as they grow, like, it's so fun. Like, kids are so fun. And I also think this is not something we talk about a whole lot, but we have a very transitory culture where we move a lot. Other people move a lot. We move for the jobs, for economy, because, you know, we're in a city that's woke or it's too expensive to live here. It's hard to have long-term relationships outside of family. And so when you don't have kids, especially because a lot of us didn't necessarily have siblings when we were growing up, like, we were in the era where the two-kid family was, you know, I grew up in a place where I was in the 80s and 90s. Not a lot of people had more than two kids. I knew a few people with three, but not more than that. And so, like, it's just a place where we don't have a lot of long-term relationships. Children are, in some ways, a long-term relationship, somebody that you know, obviously, from the moment they're born, that are going to stay with you. And there's such a richness to those kinds of, we're not just hopping in and out of relationships. This isn't just somebody that I know for a while. There is something about that longevity and that connection. It's one reason why marriage matters so much. It's another reason why parents and children matter so much. So it's sad that there is sort of an anti-child vibe out there. It's a little easier to adopt that vibe when you're in your 20s as a woman, a little bit in your early 30s. You get to your late 30s, your 40s, your 50s, you are staring down a life, especially if you don't have a church community that is not, there isn't a lot of meaning there. And at that point, it's like, a new kind of yoga pants and a restaurant and a getaway vacation. You've done it all. And better to be at that phase of life, watching your children get married and start their businesses and do amazing things in the world and, you know, play in college soccer matches and things like that. I mean, that's where the joy is. So I just want to encourage you, if you've got children at any age, whether it's like the newborn stage or teenagers that you're just joking with and delighting with, or adult children that you're now watching form their own families, tell the world how wonderful it is, because we need a counter to those anti-child voices.
It's just interesting how little importance is given to the concept of creating actual human beings who, God willing, will outlive you. And it's what are the things that after we die continue on that we've done? Other than, you know, if you're going to be that 1% of humans who write the book that someone talks about 100 years later, or a song that people sing 100 years later, how many of us will do that sort of thing with that sort of significance? But creating new human life, and that's why I try to even advise friends that have considered, you know, should I stay at home or continue working with. Anyone can actually do your job, even if you work a really cool, really incredible job. Someone else can do it. But to your kid, you're the only person they want home. You're the only mother they want home with them. And these are stages of life, right? It's not that you have to be home, never leaving your house for 18 years. There's all these different stages and different changes, and how big or small your world might be gets to expand and contract. But how there's not anything else as significant as new human life that you get to be a part of, it seems like.
Yeah, well said.
Okay, final thought. What are a handful of things you've learned from the people in your life that mentored you when it came to marriage? Things that really helped you and Ryan stick it out for so long. I think you said you've been married 25 years?
27. And
27 years? Like, okay, so you're doing something right. So what's some advice that you got that was really helpful?
Well, what we did right is we shadowed couples that were doing it right. And we both came from divorced homes and didn't really have, we had one or two examples each in our own life of like couples that did marriage well, but we didn't watch it in our own families. And so we got married as two 22-year-olds, you know, brand new Christians, and we needed a lot of help. And thankfully, we got it. We got it at church. Every church that we went to, there was one or two couples that mentored us. And whether it was formally or informally, we just watched them and they invested in us. They gave us advice. And it was really helpful because I would have women that I knew loved me and I would walk into church. And, you know, one of them said, Katie, do you see what you're wearing today? Turn around, go home and change, because I don't want my husband to stumble. And I'm like, oh, geez. But she was right. Like, I didn't understand the importance of dressing modestly. And only a woman that was invested in my life could say it. I'd had other women who would say, hey, Katie, do you see how you just talked about Ryan in front of all of those people? Don't ever do that again. That is so disrespectful. And there's no way to diminish your husband as somebody that's a confident leader as criticizing him in front of other people. You can say that to him privately. So my advice for you, young couples, go to a great church, find a few people a few steps ahead of you, pattern yourselves after them, say, invest in my life, tell me how to do that, because you need it to form a successful marriage.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.